Welcome to this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized today's event. We'd like to welcome our online and radio audiences as well as our audience here, and we invite everyone to visit us at www.commonwealthclub.org. It's my great pleasure tonight to introduce Professor Morris, who I've heard speak before and asked to come here to the Commonwealth Club, on his book, Why the West Rules for Now. He's the author of the book, also a professor of archaeology at Stanford. And I have to say that the sweep of history, and I've read all of Durant's books, which took forever to go through, but the sweep of history and the putting of the pieces of what's important in there is just a fascinating example of how you can fit all of human history in 700, 800 pages. But I think in addition to that, in one of his examples, in talking about the Roman Empire, he said, I would like to go back to an ancient text to give a really good idea about what the British Empire did for its subject peoples. But the best quote comes from a movie by Monty Python called The Life of Brian. And he's absolutely right. I've always thought that that not only is the best, you know, excuse for an empire, but it's also the best, by analogy, reason why the British Empire was at least well-liked by some people. Professor Morris.
Well, thank you. I'd like to thank George for that wonderful and kind introduction and for inviting me here to speak this evening. And thank all of you for coming out this evening to hear what I've got to say. And, of course, I should apologize for the slight technical meltdown at the beginning. I do this. Pretty much everywhere I go I wreak havoc and chaos. First of all, apparently I told George I wasn't planning to show pictures, and then I decided today when I got up that I had told him I was going to show the pictures. And then I get here and the computer won't communicate with anything and nothing is working. But as chaos goes, that's not so bad. I went through a phase when I became a one-man financial meltdown. Everywhere I went in the world, the economy immediately collapsed. I talked about this book in Athens when the government first admitted that their predecessors had been cooking the books for the previous 3 or 4 years. And then I went on and talked in Abu Dhabi. And while I was there, Dubai World confessed that they couldn't meet their interest payments anymore, and the economy fell through the floor. And a few weeks ago, I talked in Hong Kong about it, and I foolishly made a little quip saying, well, at least he I won't cause your economy to melt down. And as you may know, the Hong Kong Stock Exchange has collapsed since I left there. So, all things considered, you probably want me to finish quickly and go away before something really terrible happens. But as disasters go, though, I guess this is my point, as disasters go, tonight was really very, very mild. Okay, so I've come here to talk about this book, Why the West Rules for Now, that came out about a year ago and just came out in paperback too. So basically what I want to do, I'm going to talk, I think we said sort of in the 30 to 45 minute range, so if you want to set your alarm clocks to wake you up for the end, this is the right moment to do that. I'm going to talk about this book for 30, 45 minutes, and basically I want to cover three things in the talk. First of all, I want to talk a little bit about what I see as the big patterns in history and what the largest shape of human history has been like. Then the second thing I want to do is talk a little bit about the explanation and why the pattern of history looks the way that it does. And then the final part, I'm going to just draw 3 points out of the first two parts of the talk, 3 things that I think are interesting about this, and say a few words about them, and then I'll stop. So that's the basic plan. Now, like George was telling you, by background, I'm an archaeologist, an ancient historian. I've worked mostly in the Mediterranean basin. So you might be wondering, why is somebody like that coming to talk about a topic as big and broad as why the West rules for now? And there's actually, I think, a pretty good reason for it. This question, why the West, in the last couple of hundred years, why a small group of nations around the shores of the North Atlantic, why they came to dominate the planet in the last couple of hundred years, this is a question that really lies at the origins of a lot of the research that's been done on the civilizations of the ancient Mediterranean, how they came about, why they're important. This is an old question for people interested in the classical world. It's driven a lot of the work that's been done. And basically, what happened is that about 250 years ago, Europeans discovered that they had a problem. And the problem that they got was a pretty good problem, as problems go, which was that they appeared to be taking over the world and they didn't know why. And they had been under the impression they were about to be conquered by the Turks or something, other terrible things would happen to them. Instead, they find they are conquering the world. So all these arguments start blowing up about 250 years ago about why is this happening? And the one that ended up being the most influential was an idea that 2,500 years earlier, this theory ran, that became more and more influential. A unique civilization gets created in ancient Greece on the slopes of the Acropolis in Athens. This civilization arises, which is unlike any previous civilization. It's uniquely creative, these thinkers start saying. It was uniquely democratic, uniquely scientific. Everything about the ancient Greeks was just great. The ancient Greek civilization was better than any other civilization the world had ever seen. So the theory runs, and like I say, this starts getting popular around about 1750. More and more Europeans start championing this theory. Theory runs, the Greeks invent this unique civilization. It is passed down and spread around through the Roman Empire, spreads it all over Europe, gets passed down through subsequent ages, until finally we come to the pinnacle of Western civilization. Now, this is the pinnacle of Western civilization. You may not realize it, but this is a photograph. I hope you can all see my wonderful photograph here. This is a photograph taken in my hometown in the month that I was born. And it's a little hard to tell through all the smog and grime what exactly we're looking at, but I'm pretty sure the hospital I was born in is just a little bit off to the left of the picture. So hence, I say, obviously, the pinnacle of Western civilization. But of course, I jest. Here is the pinnacle of Western civilization. I was actually... Thank you. I'm heartbroken to discover this picture has apparently been doctored, as has the one I showed you of lightning striking the Acropolis in Athens, which was used in newspapers all over the world when the Greek economy fell off the cliff. And then people later discovered it had all been cooked on a computer, which is too bad, but I see no reason to let little details like that stop me from using these pictures. So, okay, this theory then. In my book, I call this an example of a long-term lock-in theory. And the idea behind this theory, and several similar ones, is that something happened a very long time ago that locked in Western supremacy over the rest of the world. And this particular theory says ancient Greek culture, different from and better than all other cultures in the world, Europeans have inherited ancient Greek culture, therefore Europeans go on to conquer the world and colonize large parts of it. All makes complete sense if you buy into the basic premise is that this Greek civilization was completely unique. Now, this theory, it was tremendously successful. In the 19th century in particular, just enormously influential all over the world. But in the 20th century, it more and more broke down as the century went on, for all kinds of reasons. Some people lost confidence in the idea that the West was dominating the world as the world wars broke out, genocides, all kinds of terrible stuff. Some people said, well, as we get to know more and more about the world, this idea that something special happened in ancient Greece, this seems to explain less and less of the evidence that we now have as the 20th century goes on. And then particularly, toward the end of the 20th century, as people started to see the explosive economic growth, first of all of Japan, then of the Asian tigers, then, of course, in the last 20 years or so of China. This is the city of Chongqing. This one has not been doctored. One side of the city really is like this disgustingly muddy river. The other side is still relatively clean for the time being. Explosive economic growth going on in East Asia in the late 20th century. More and more people start saying, well, if the long-term lock-in theories are right, and something happened in ancient Greece which determined that the West would come to dominate the world, then why is Chongqing Chongqing? Why is this happening if this older theory is right? The whole new bunch of theories start coming up the last 20 or 30 years. In my book, I like to call them short-term accident theories, because this is basically the gist behind all of them, even though they vary a lot. The basic idea is all this stuff about ancient Greece got nothing to do with anything. The West came to dominate the world, people said, because something happened very recently. It wasn't locked in 2,500 years ago. Very recent, in the last couple of centuries. And in fact, a lot of people said it's accidental as well. Something weird happened that triggered an industrial revolution in Europe, but nowhere else. That gave the West the ability to project its power globally, which no one had had before. That's why the world sort of is the shape that it is. And the implication of the long-term lock-in theories tends to be that the West is going to go on dominating the world. It was locked in a long time ago. The implication of the short-term accident theories is the West, opinions vary. Some will say it may go on dominating the world. Others will say it's not going to go on dominating the world. But it's completely up in the air, basically. It's an accidental thing, a very short-term thing. Nothing is set in stone. Now, okay, last 20 years or so, academics have gotten very, very agitated over these two broad theories. And they have been calling each other all kinds of names. There have been a couple of occasions, to my knowledge, where people have come to blows over these theories at academic conferences, which always, you know, livens things up a little bit. But it suggests that maybe something is not going the way it's supposed to in academia when we actually have to start hitting each other. So my sense of this, when I started writing this book, you know, in the middle of the last decade, my sense was a lot of the people were kind of talking past each other. And this is why it was all getting so heated. And it reminded me, in fact, of the very famous South Asian story of the five blind men and the elephant, which I'm sure you all know the story. Five blind guys meet an elephant for reasons which are actually completely obscure. I've never seen anyone say why they meet the elephant, but they do. And five guys then, they're trying to figure out what it is. And so one grabs a leg and says, ah, it's a tree trunk. One grabs a tail and says, it's a rope. Another one grabs a tusk and says, it's a spear. And I will stop at that point, because obviously things can start getting pretty ugly quite quickly with this story. But the point of the story, very obvious. If you can't see the shape of the beast, you're not going to be able to agree on what it is you're trying to explain. If everybody's looking at a different part of it, which I think is very much what's happened in these debates, people look at different sorts of evidence, define things in different terms. If you're only looking at part of the animal, you're not going to be able to say what it is. So I thought, obvious thing we need to do is find some way to get everybody on the same page, talking about the same kind of thing. And I think there's a lot of different ways you can go about getting everybody defining their terms in the same ways and addressing each other directly. But the way I like to do this is through numerical things. Like if you're able to sort of count and weigh things, as long as you can agree on what you're counting and weighing, this forces you to argue over the same things. It doesn't make you agree about anything, but it forces you to argue at least over the same kinds of things. So I decided what I need, if I'm going to write this book, what I need is some kind of numerical index which would allow us to directly compare the shape of history over time, see whether the long-term theories or the short-term theories describe the shape of history better. Now, the problem is, of course, that is easier said than done. What I decided I needed to do was I spent some time asking myself, you know, what is this debate really all about? And I came to the conclusion it's about what in the book I call social development, by which I basically just mean society's abilities to get things done in the world, to like master the intellectual and physical environment around them and get the things they want out of the world, impose their will on the world, make things happen. This, I decided, was what it's really all about. The long-term lock-in theories say there's something special about Western social development going back thousands of years. Short-term accident people say, no, there isn't. I mean, that's basically what it comes down to. Yes, there is. No, there isn't. If we can find some way to measure social development and compare it through space and over time, then we can, I think, start having a more sensible and constructive kind of argument about this. Now, while I was writing the book, and I started traveling around giving talks to academic groups about this book that I was writing, I thought that the sensible way to do these talks would be I would go in, I would do a little preamble like we just had, and then I would talk for about 20, 30 minutes about my index of social development. Now, I learned a great lesson. I'm a professor. I've been doing this for like a quarter of a century now. I've become intimately familiar with the sense of the room going to sleep. That's something you become very familiar with when you're lecturing to large groups of undergraduates first thing in the morning. I had no idea what a room full of sleeping people looked like until I started my long discourses on the Index of Social Development. So I learned an important lesson. Don't do that. So I'm not going to do that to you. You'll be, I'm sure, delighted to know. It's clearly... I am the only person in the world who finds this topic obsessively interesting. But I do, but I'm not going to inflict it on you right now. If you've got questions about the index, I am happy, really happy, to go on at some length afterwards. So, you know, you've been warned. If you want to ask about it, you have been warned. Any kind of exercise in quantifying the past like this, it gets you into all kinds of technical issues. And the thing is, of course, these technical issues are vital for what I'm doing. Because if I'm just wrong about a lot of this stuff, then everything else I'm going to say tonight is wrong as well. So I've ended up writing a whole separate book, which will be out next year, which is just about the Social Development Index. So if you really like things like this, that's the place to go for it. There's a certain amount about it in my book as well. But I'm not going to spend a great deal of time talking about it tonight. Just to tell you a few quick things about it, then get on with the story. The idea of assigning these social development scores and comparing them over time, this isn't something that allows you to be objective about what's going on. You still have to make lots and lots of assumptions to do this scoring system. But I think its big advantage is it does make you be explicit. You have to be able to say, you know, these are the scores I'm assigning. These are why I scored in this way, not in some other way. This is the evidence I've looked at to generate these scores, which is why, of course, the whole topic becomes quite as boring as it does, because it's basically a matter of amassing information and then cramming it into analytical frameworks. What I needed to do, I realized, because this is an argument over whether we're dealing with a long-term or a short-term pattern, I need to look back a very long way in history. So my index goes back 15,000 years to the end of the last ice age, which is, you know, a pretty long time. I think everybody would agree. The problem that that then brings on is that the kinds of evidence you've got available to talk about, say, what happened in the 20th century or what happened in the Middle Ages, as you'll be hearing about with the intimate history of the Black Death, or what the world was like in prehistoric societies, wildly different sorts of evidence. The whole thing gets very complicated, lots and lots of room to argue. There's also a lot of conceptual issues involved. What do I need to do in order to generate these scores? And I ended up actually taking most of my inspiration from another scoring exercise that I'm sure some of you will be familiar with, the United Nations Human Development Index, which is this thing the UN produces a new version every year. They're interested in measuring how well do governments do in creating the conditions that allow their citizens to realize their innate human potential. And they hired these economists who sat down and said, okay, that's what we need to measure. Very vague concept. What is the smallest number of traits that we can look at, which actually cover the whole range of what is meant here and can also be measured? And this was the principle that I tried to use in constructing my index. And I ended up looking at four different traits to try to measure social development over time, and then just assigning scores to them. And the way my index works, very simple thing, it runs from 0 points up to 1,000 points. 1,000 points was the maximum score that it's theoretically possible to get for a society in the year 2000 AD, which is where I cut off because it's a nice round number. No society actually got 1,000 points for various technical reasons. Zero is the lowest it's theoretically possible to get. But again, no society can actually score zero because one of my traits is per capita energy capture, how much energy each individual absorbs from the world. And if you absorb zero energy, you die. So no society has ever scored 0 points. If you stop breathing, you'll be dead in certainly within 4 or 5 minutes. If you stop drinking water, you'll be dead in 4 or 5 days. Well, actually less. If you stop eating, you'll be dead in 4 or 5 weeks. So a simple sort of multiplier effect here. So nobody ever scores zero, but some societies right after the Ice Age are not that far above zero. Okay, so that is my preamble to what I'm doing. What do we see after I spent months and months and months on this index. I love tinkering around with graphs and tables and stuff. I had a great time. Spent a very long time on it. And after all my time that poured into this, we ended up with this. Yeah, everybody laughs. You have no idea how this wounds me when everybody laughs at my index. Over time, again, I've grown and I've come to see what is vaguely amusing about this graph. The obviously amusing thing is unless your eyesight is a lot better than mine, which of course it, you know, could be at this point in my life, it's kind of hard to see very much going on in this graph. The lines are actually just what color do
very strange colours here. Okay, that's supposed to be blue and red.
Yes, the lines are supposed to be blue and red, and I will leave it to your imagination to figure out which is which. But let me tell you, first of all, what we're looking at. On the vertical axis, 0 to 1,000 points on my index. On the horizontal axis is time from 14,000 BC, last phases of the ice, phases of the Ice Age, through to 2000 AD. The line that's supposed to be blue represents Western societies. The line that's supposed to be red represents Eastern societies. And I'll come back in a moment to what exactly I mean by Western and Eastern, because that's obviously important. And also to why there's only two lines on this graph out of all the places I could have looked at in the world. And what the scores are showing us here is the score, the social development score for the region within the West or the East that is most developed at each point in time. Now, what we see when we look at the graph is, well, not very much for most of the time on this graph. For thousands of years, the lines drag along the very, very bottom of the graph. Then they begin to lift off the graph maybe 3,000-4,000 years ago, lift off the very bottom. Then you get to about 200 years ago, and they take like a 90-degree turn and shoot almost straight up in the last 200 years. Now, what to make of that? Well, one obvious observation about that. This is something that a short-term accident theorist, I think, would like more than a long-term lock-in theorist. The short-term guys say something dramatic happened very recently, and that certainly seems to be what this graph is showing us. Second thing that I think a short-term accident theorist would like about my graph is that the blue and the red lines are really, really hard to tell apart. They're almost the whole of history. If you believe something set the West apart a very long time ago, it shouldn't look like this. Now, having said that, the problem with this graph is that the first of the observations I talked about, the way the lines suddenly shoot up at the very end, that largely explains the second, the fact that it's so hard to tell them apart. The scores go so high in the last couple of hundred years that to fit them on the graph, you have to squish everything else down into the very, very bottom. You can't really see what's going on. The next graph is going to show you exactly the same data points, but just leaving off the final score for the year 2000. I calculate the scores every 100 years. So the next graph, exactly the same, but stops in the year 1900. What we see here, very, very different. The graph has now been pulled upwards because we don't have to go as high on the vertical axis. What you see now is there's actually kind of a lot going on in those earlier phases. And in particular, what we see here, the previous graph, it looked like the lines are basically flat through almost the whole of history, then abruptly shoot upwards. We now see that's not the case at all. The scores have generally been rising since the late Ice Age, very, very slowly at first, but then the pace of the increase has been accelerating, not steadily, but has been accelerating strongly across the last 14,000 years. So that's something a little bit different. We also see that the two lines, the reddish, brownish, and blue lines, they're not the same. And in fact, the blue score has been higher than the red score for something like 90% of the time since the end of the last Ice Age. Actually, this is the dark, I'm going to say dark and light. The dark was the one that was red, the light is the one that was blue. This must be extremely confusing. The light line represents the Western scores. The dark line represents the Eastern scores. The light line has been higher than the dark line for like 90% of the time since the end of the Ice Age. That's something a long-term lock-in theorist would really, really like. The problem with that, though, is that the dark line has not been, the light line has not been higher than the dark line for the entire time. And if you're a long-term lock-in theorist, it really ought to be. If something happened thousands of years ago to lock in Western dominance, then you shouldn't have... let me see, do I have a little pointy on this? Oh, yeah, here we are. You shouldn't have this period here where the dark line is clearly higher than the light line. And this is not a little period. This is 1,200 years. This is a really long period. From about the year 550 to 750, Eastern social development is higher than Western. That's a real problem. Final thing we see going on here is that while the scores are generally rising as you go from left to right across the graph, they're not consistently rising. There are periods when they stagnate, even periods when they decline. And that's something we're going to have to explain if we want to understand this why the West rules question. Okay, now, to appreciate the true beauty of all my graphs and my index, what you need to do, of course, is buy my book and read it from cover to cover. But since I've got you here tonight, what I'm going to do now is move on to the second thing I want to talk about, which is what might explain this pattern I've just been talking about. Because that, I think, is where things begin to get really interesting. And I think they get interesting because I have a one-word answer to explain all of these patterns we've been looking at. And that one word is geography. And by that, I mean it's not great men who drive the shape of history or religion or politics or culture. It's not even accidents. Geography has been what's driven the shape of history that we've just been looking at in these graphs. And it seems to me that that actually makes a lot of sense. One of the things we've learned from archaeology and genetics in the last 50 years has been that people are basically all the same wherever you find them on the planet. There are differences, but the differences are trivial. People are basically all the same. We've also learned that societies have developed along basically the same kind of paths all around the world, which again shouldn't surprise us. If the people are all pretty much the same, then we shouldn't be too surprised if the societies they make all develop in much the same ways. The thing that's made the difference between different parts of the world is the fact that they are different parts of the world. People who are all much the same get together in societies which develop in similar kinds of ways, but they do this in different places. The geography has driven how societies have developed over time. And that's the basic argument of the book. Now, you may well be saying, now, you were told in the introduction, this guy wrote a 750-page book. Why did he need a 750-page book to give you a one-word explanation of the whole of human history? That seems a bit indulgent, to put it mildly. Well, two reasons. First reason is that basically, if you have a thesis like this, that X explains the shape of history, the only way you can really test a theory like that is, of course, by looking constantly at points in time where it looks like something else is actually in the driving seat. So to write the book, a lot of the book consists of telling the story of history, of all the things people do, showing how, in fact, it's been geography driving things along the whole time. Second reason the book ended up being a long one, though, is that as I was writing it, I realized that while geography is a one-word answer, geography itself is a very, very messy concept. Because it's like there's two things going on at the same time. One is that geography drives how societies develop. Geography drives social development. But at the same time, what I realized as I kind of plodded my way through the history, is that the ways societies develop drive what the geography means. So it's like it's a two-way street. Geography driving development, development changing what geography means. Now, okay, so a lot of the book then consists of tracing this story, this back and forth between social development and geography. And the book takes us across, you know, a 15,000-year progress through this. I'm not going to do that tonight. Again, more good news for you. What I'm going to do, though, because I think you're... one of the differences between history writing and being in the natural sciences is that in the natural sciences, when you claim you've discovered a scientific law, it ideally will be something that can be expressed very simply, ideally, again, in mathematical form. If you're a historian and you say, well, we tend to avoid saying we found laws, but we like to talk about finding generalities and large patterns. If you say, I found a large pattern and geography drives history, that doesn't really mean very much until you start putting some actual history into it and showing how it works. So what I want to do, rather than sort of zipping very quickly through the whole of history, I'm going to zip back just to about 500 or 600 years to look at what I think is the biggest example of how geography has driven social development, but at the same time, social development has driven what geography means. And then after I've looked at for a few minutes at that example, talk a little bit about some of the implications of this theory and what it might tell us. Okay, so that's the basic plan for the rest of the time. So if we were to zip back about 500 years, here is a map of the world about 500 years ago. Zip back about 500, 600 years, what you would find is that China is very much the center of the world at this point. Social development in China considerably higher than anywhere else in the world. It's the golden age of pre-modern Chinese culture. It's coming to the end of a period when most of the great classics of Chinese literature and art have been produced. If if a sinologist says, you know, I'm a specialist in classical Chinese poetry, what they mean is the poetry of what Europeans would call the Middle Ages. My necktie that I'm wearing tonight has a Tang Dynasty poem on it. My mother-in-law gave me my necktie, so I wasn't 100% sure what it said. But I've been assured that this really is a very famous Tang Dynasty poem. All of the classics of Chinese culture and literature, pre-modern, come from this period. It's the golden age of pre-modern Chinese science and technology as well. And I want to start off explaining this back and forth between geography and development by talking a little bit about one particular bit of social development, which is the sort of technological scientific side of this. Because two things that the Chinese come up with in this period begin to change the meanings of geography more spectacularly than they've ever been changed before. Now, okay, so I'm going to talk about just two things the Chinese come up with. One of them is reliable ocean-going ships. Now, there have been ships that have been crossing oceans for a very long time before this, but they tend to do it by accident. Or, say, in the case of the Vikings, because climatic circumstances are just very favorable for a while. But by about the year 1200, Chinese mariners are inventing the kinds of sails and rudders and compasses that give you ships that could be reliably used to cross thousands of miles of open sea, if you wanted to do that. You could sail more or less wherever in the world you wanted to go, in a ship like the one you see here at the bottom left. This is a ship. This one was built by a group of Chinese merchants in Taiwan. I think they built it in like 2008. Because they were upset that some Western historians were still skeptical about whether Chinese ships of the 15th century really could have sailed all over the world. So they build this ship and say, we're going to cross the Pacific Ocean to show that this can be done. So this is what they do. Off they go. Now, it's a long way. To go with the winds and tides you have to use to cross the Pacific, it's about an 8,000-mile trip to get from China to California. It's a long way. Off they go. They sail, they sail, they sail. Eventually, in 2009, they end up in the San Francisco Bay. And I don't know if any of you went down and saw the Princess Taiping when it got. It was surprisingly little advertised. But they sail into the San Francisco Bay in this 15th-century ship. They refit there, all very happy. Now, the problem they've got is that so far they've done the easy bit. And as somebody who couldn't sail like across this room by himself, obviously my version of easy is rather unwise use of the word. But for a mariner, that was the easy bit. Getting from China to America, that's relatively easy. Getting back is the tricky bit. But off they go. They're determined to prove this can be done. Off they go. And they sail and they sail and they sail. And finally, they're getting very close to Taiwan. They're 20 miles off the coast of Taiwan. And in the middle of the night, while the crew is asleep, a giant steel tanker slices the ship in two, which is what you see in the top right. Now, the good news is nobody died. This was mixed news, is of course the ship sank like a stone. But the people who'd built the ship pointed out, yes, we did get sunk like a stone, but if this had been the 15th century, there wouldn't have been a giant steel tanker. It would have all been fine. Now, of course, the whole thing was a slightly silly exercise because any reputable historian already knew, yes, Chinese ships could have made this voyage back in the 15th century if they'd wanted to. The technology spreads like wildfire. Within a couple of centuries from when these inventions get made in the 13th, 14th centuries, they spread all the way across Eurasia, 5,000 miles out to Western Europe. The Europeans are building ships inspired by these Chinese ideas, start sailing off all over the place. This begins to change what the geography means. And this is the first of these great inventions that China makes that changes the world at this point. The second of the inventions is guns. Everybody loves guns. And the picture at the top left is the oldest known true gun in the world, made in 1288 in Manchuria in northern China. A true gun because you can pack it with gunpowder, which will then explode and fire a projectile out of the end and kill somebody. So that was made in 1288. The picture at the bottom is an illustration painted in a manuscript at Oxford in the year 1327, which shows you a much improved version of a gun, more like a cannon in this case. In 39 years, or perhaps even less than that, this invention crosses 5,000 miles from Manchuria to England. This is the fastest that any invention has been known to spread in the history of the world up to that point, which is why I say everybody loves guns. Guns spread even faster than the ships. But you put them together, you get a remarkable package. You get ships that can cross the oceans and guns that can kill the people you meet on the other side. And this is fantastic. Now, what happens is, up to this point in history, Western Europe has been very much like a peripheral backwater in history. It's stuck out into the cold waters of the North Atlantic, a long way from all the real centres of action. Nothing terribly exciting in global terms is going on in Western Europe. That abruptly changes in the 15th century. Once the Europeans get a hold of this package, once they get a hold of the package, the new ships and the guns as well, but particularly the ships, these change the meanings of geography. Up to this point, the Atlantic has been a giant barrier. It's too big to cross reliably. It cuts the old world off from the new world. Once you get the new package, and particularly after about 1600, when the Europeans begin to nail down the details, the Atlantic abruptly changes from being a barrier into being a superhighway. The new ships are able to zip around the Atlantic, and all kinds of remarkable things start to happen. And in particular, it turns out the Atlantic Ocean is kind of a Goldilocks ocean. It's neither too big nor too small. It's big enough that the continents that abut the North Atlantic are very different. They have very different natural resources, very different kinds of societies in them. It's small enough that these European ships can zip around it, trading at every point they stop at. And this is the period in history when the famous triangular trades of the Atlantic develop. And this map sort of roughly represents them. But what the triangular trades mean is that you can start off in Northwest Europe, where you've got societies producing manufactured goods. You can load up a boat with your manufactured goods, take it down to West Africa, trade your manufactured goods for slaves, because you're dealing with very different sorts of societies. Fill your boat with slaves. You make a profit on that exchange. You sail across to the Caribbean. You swap the slaves there for sugar or tobacco or rum. You make a profit again. You sail back to England or France with your sugar, tobacco or rum. You swap that for more manufactured goods, making another profit, and off you go back to West Africa, generating profits at every point on your trips. There's never been an engine for making profits like this in the entire history of the world. The Atlantic changes its meaning, and as it changes its meaning, it begins to drive up social development in Western Europe. Remarkable set of things start to happen. As the Europeans realize, we now have access to this whole new ocean that kind of wasn't there before. The new version of the Atlantic generates unimaginable levels of profits. These profits start flooding back into Europe. Europeans start asking themselves, how can we get even more profits? Because we like these profits. How can we get more of them? They say to themselves, some of them say to themselves, if we really understood how the physical world worked, we could get even more profits here. If we really understood how the stars move in the sky, why the winds blow, how the oceans move, how to make a proper map, we could just change everything. And all over Europe, the most serious thinkers start trying to address these problems. They realize very quickly, if we're going to do this, we need a whole new mathematical language. And they start to figure one out. And famously, Newton and Leibniz, in more or less the same year, both claim to have invented calculus, the secret for figuring out a lot of these things. Whole new community of scholars starts thinking about a new set of problems. As they do so, Europe has the famous scientific revolution. Now, Europe has this not because Europeans are cleverer than Chinese or Indians or Arabs, but because Europeans are having a new set of questions thrust onto them by the new meanings of geography. In the 18th century, Europeans start taking these new scientific methods they've developed and turning them back onto their own society, saying, well, what is the logic of how societies work? Do we have to keep doing things in the way people have done them in the past? So you start getting guys like Locke and Tom Paine and Voltaire and Rousseau, and what the Europeans call the Enlightenment. And again, not because Europeans are smarter or more democratic, but because new questions are being thrust onto them by geography. Now, as the 18th century goes on and the profits are rolling into Western Europe, particularly rolling into Britain, which has come to dominate this Atlantic economy, it starts transforming European social development in yet more ways. New kinds of market economies start to flourish. People tap into these new flows of resources. As they do so, wages start getting driven higher and higher, again, particularly in Britain. The British start to worry that their goods are being priced out of markets in Europe because the wages are so high. Now, British entrepreneurs, like others in Europe, they would very much like to find a way to substitute machine power for labour power, because that would allow them to bypass a lot of these high-wage problems that they've got. People all over Europe are trying to solve this problem, but the British are confronting it most acutely. And not surprisingly, it's the British who solve it first. Geography pushes it onto them most seriously. By 1800, the British begin to tap into the awe-inspiring power of steam and coal. The British have an industrial revolution. Again, although it pains me to say it, not because the British are cleverer or work harder than anybody else. We were just the ones who happened to live in the British Isles. By 1850, the British are able to project their power globally. They bestride the world like a colossus. So, okay, that's why the West rules. The geography has driven the West coming to rule the planet. But my title, as you probably remember, my title is Why the West Rules for Now. Geography, I think, also explains the for now bit. Now, 35 years ago. So when I was a high school student in Britain, back in the 1970s, studying modern history, there was a remarkable fact that I didn't really realize how remarkable it was at the time, but all of our high school history textbooks stopped around the year 1850. Now, that is a very convenient place to stop history if you happen to be British, while you're bestriding the world like a colossus. Britain's problem was history didn't stop in 1850, and we are still struggling to come to terms with this uncomfortable truth. History didn't stop. In fact, the same kinds of forces continued working. Western Europe had been catapulted to the top of the global pile by the way the Atlantic basically shrank from about 1400 on with the new kinds of technology, the new forms of organization of society. After 1850, the shrinkage accelerates. New kinds of ships come in, like steamships come in. The railroads come in. The telegraph comes in. North America, here, let's have another trade routes map. I forgot I was going to talk about that. So I'm sorry. North America goes in the 19th century from being this periphery that feeds the British-dominated economy to increasingly becoming the center of this economy itself. North America starts catching up with Britain in the late 19th century, overtakes Britain in industrialization in the early 20th century. By 1950, the USA, as the geographies continue changing its meanings, the spaces of North America and the Atlantic have continued shrinking. The USA has replaced Britain as the great power that dominates the world like a colossus. Now, I didn't study history in an American high school in the 1970s, but I've been reliably assured by people who did, and some of you may actually remember this, that American modern history textbooks tended to stop in the year 1950. Very convenient place. America's problem, once again, is that history didn't stop in 1950. The same forces that had shrunk the Atlantic continued accelerating, and in the late 20th century, they shrank the Pacific. This is, of course, what made San Francisco what it is today, the shrinkage of the Pacific, creating these great ports on the west coast of the United States. But what it also did is container ships came in, jet airliners, the internet. The distances of the Pacific, which for so long have been a barrier in the world, difficult and expensive to cross, by the late 20th century, they're not difficult and expensive to cross anymore. East Asia goes, first of all, from being a periphery that feeds the growth of the North American economy into being a new core in its own right. By the year 2011, East Asia is catching up on North America, driven once again by the changing meanings of geography. So, okay, that's the title of my book, Why the West Rules for Now. The very last thing I want to do, just to wrap up, is to, like I said at the beginning, draw three quick points out of this, which I think are sort of interesting points to say a word or two about. And these points address the subtitle in the book of Why the West Rules for Now, the patterns of history and what they reveal about the future. Because I think this is just not just an interesting story to tell, but one which actually tells us something about what may happen next. One of the things you can do, if you spend as long as I did making these graphs of the shape of history in Western and Eastern social development, one of the things you can do is project them forward. Say, well, what will happen if recent trends were to continue? Now, when you're doing this, of course, you're being particularly unobjective doing this, because to project forward, you have to make all kinds of assumptions about what you think is going to be going on. And so for the graph I'm going to show you, I've made what I think a very conservative set of assumptions, saying what will happen if in the 21st century, Eastern and Western development continue to rise at the same rates that they did in the 20th, which is obviously a conservative assumption because development is clearly accelerating. What would happen if they did continue to rise at the same rates? And what we see here on this graph is the pale line, the Western line, being caught up by the dark Eastern line and then overtaken. So that is what will happen if things continue down the path that they're on. And in fact, not only can I show you a graph showing that this will happen, I can even tell you when this will happen. It will happen in the year 2103. So make a note of that. That's an important date. Now, I was always told, if you're going to make predictions, there are two vital things you must have in your prediction. First, it must be precise, so people know. If we get to 2104 and it hasn't happened, I was wrong. You must be precise. Second, it must play out after you're dead. Otherwise, it can get very ugly. So this, of course, is perfect prediction. Now, what the prediction means, though, is if the arguments I have been making in my book are correct, this is driven by the changing meanings of geography. This is not something that people are able to control what's happening. That, you know, obviously, it's important what happens with the meetings of the Deficit Reduction Super Committee that is thinking great thoughts even as we speak, I'm sure. This obviously makes a great difference to things, but it's not going to change much about this graph. It may speed up or slow down the shift in wealth and power around the world, but the shift in wealth and power is driven by geographical forces we cannot control. We can manage them to a certain extent, but we can't control them. My efforts to manage them, my book has recently been translated into Mandarin, which is what you see on the left. I think they did a very good job with the cover. They're taking the cover off the US edition and had it dissolving into letters tumbling off the bottom of the page at the bottom. So yes, we can learn to manage what may be happening, but we can't control the larger shape of history. Okay, second observation. Oops, I want to make here. Second observation. I talked about where the two lines meet here and where it falls on the bottom of the graph down here in 2103. We can also talk about where that crossing point is over here on the vertical axis. The lines cross around 5,000 points on my axis. What that means, to get from the cave paintings on the walls at Chauvet and Altamira at the end of the last ice age to the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco, that's 900 points on the social development index. To get from the Commonwealth Club to 2103 is 4,000 points. Four times as much change as the world has seen in the last 14,000 years. That's an extraordinary prediction to make. It's one that I feel that, you know, nobody's really qualified to say what the world's going to look like at 5,000 points. But I do want to stress again, this is a conservative assumption. If change continues at 20th century rates, we will see four times as much change as the whole of history since the end of the last ice age has already seen. That might sound kind of wild and silly, but what historians often like to say is that the next 100 years may well see more change than the last 100,000 years. And when people doubt that, what historians will often also go on to say is, if you don't believe that, reflect on the fact that the last 100 years has already seen more change than the last 100,000 years, particularly in what it means to be a human being. And I suspect that one of the predictions about the 21st century that is likely to turn out to be true is that human beings in 2103 might be utterly different animals from we human beings who are sitting in this room. I have no idea how we'll be different, but I suspect that we will be different. And what people mean when they say the last 100 years have already seen more change than the previous 100,000. If we'd lived anywhere in the world, any time up to about, say, 300 years ago, half of us in this room would have been dead before our second birthdays. Child mortality was that high. Half of you would not have made it to this room. Out of the half who survived your first 2 years, A good number of you wouldn't be here now anyway, because the average age, even for those who survived the great infant killing off, average age at death is going to be in the mid to low to mid-40s. Bulk of us wouldn't be here. Those who were here, we'd have no teeth, we'd be half blind, we'd be racked with internal parasites, we'd have terrible arthritis, we would be a mess. I mean, perhaps you are already a mess, I don't know. But we would be a mess. Everything about this room would seem like magic to almost everybody who's lived in the entire history of the world. In particular, I think the thing that would most strike them as magic is the way we have begun merging with our technology, which is, I suspect, what's going to be the real driver in the next 100 years. Some of you may, on the inside, look like this guy in the top left here, who's a man with a pacemaker, who's merged with technology to the point that if he stopped merging with technology, he would drop dead relatively soon. That's a pretty serious merging. Bottom right is my favorite example of the merging. A man I'm sure some of you will know of, Oscar Pistorius, a South African sprinter, very good sprinter. He lost his legs in an accident. Undeterred, he decided, I'm going to get artificial legs and I'm going to keep competing seriously. Gets his artificial legs and off he goes. Begins to create some problems when in 2007 it begins to look like he's going to qualify for the Olympic Games on his artificial legs. The International Olympic Committee meets and says in its wisdom, he's not allowed to run anymore. It's not fair for guys with no legs to run against guys who do have legs. That's cheating. This becomes big news because it's utterly humiliating for the IOC, who God knows have enough problems without this. They rapidly reverse their decision. Luckily for them, he fails to qualify by, I think, a fifth of a second. But he is almost certainly going to be there in the 2012 Olympics. This, again, magic to almost the entire history of the world. Okay, so this is, I think, one possible outcome of the 21st century is magic. Human beings will become utterly different from what they've been for the last 100,000 years. Unless, of course, they don't. And the very last point I want to touch on is the question, what could conceivably happen to prevent Oscar Pistorius from looking primitive and backward? A merging of human and technology that makes all this look like child's play. Well, I think that looking at history again gives us a bit of a sense here. This is a graph we've seen earlier of social development up to the year 1900. And one of the things I remarked on was how very often, particularly when you see the slopes rising very sharply, when development is really rising quickly, that then leads to stagnation followed by collapse. Now, this is something I think that conceivably could be our fate in the 21st century. When you look at the great episodes of collapse through history, you see the same five things over and over again. You see mass migrations on a scale that no government is able to control. You see epidemic diseases, often driven by the migrations that merge disease pools that had previously been separate, bring them together, cook up nasty new bugs that nobody is immune to. You see the failure and collapse of states, often driven by the migrations and the diseases. The states can't cope with these. The governments begin to unravel. As the governments unravel, often very, very violently in wars with each other, we see massive famines sweeping across the developed areas of the world as the governments are no longer able to police markets and control trade routes. And then in every single case of a major collapse, somewhere in the mix is major climate change. Now, you don't need me to tell you that these five forces are ones that a lot of people are worrying about very, very seriously in the world right now. I think it's distinctly possible that the 21st century trajectory could be a rerun of these collapses we've seen over and over again in history, with one big difference, which is this. This is the biggest nuclear explosion, above-ground explosion that ever took place, 57 megatons, a Soviet nuclear test 50 years ago. If we go through an episode of collapse on the scale, say, of the fall of the Roman Empire, it seems to me that nuclear war is a highly plausible side effect of it. The good news is that for every 20 nuclear warheads that existed in 1986, only one exists now. So we couldn't kill everybody on Earth in one day anymore. That's the good news. The bad news is we could build them all again within the space of a few weeks if we really put our minds to it. So that's a bit depressing, so I will get rid of that picture quickly. Okay, so to close, seems to me that there are some interesting things we can learn from this long view of history. And the big conclusion, I would say I felt that I'd reached from writing this book, is that the 21st century is going to be a race. But it's not going to be the race I thought it was when I started writing the book, which was this race between East and West to see which dominates the world. I think, in fact, the 21st century is going to be a race between a transformation of humanity beyond anything we can imagine and a disaster that is also beyond anything we can imagine. So on that cheery note, I will stop. And thank you very much for listening. Thank you. Thank you.
I'd like to remind our radio and online audiences that we're listening to Professor Morris, the author of Why the West Rules for Now. And anyone who has a question can come up. I'll ask the first question. If for most of history we've muddled through, why do you predict that it's either all or nothing in the 21st century?
Yeah, very good question. Because I think, I felt like what I learned from writing this book is that history is, it's like two things at once. On the one hand, history is the same old. You see the same things happening again and again, this sort of cyclical pattern to it. But at the same time, each time the same old things happen, they are happening in very, very different ways. Because the same old pattern is, most of the time, is driving social development upwards. And so, as the same patterns play out, they have radically different meanings as social development gets higher and higher. And I think one of the big changes between the 21st century and all earlier periods of history, really, has been that as social development has gone up, the scale of the societies has grown and grown and grown. And they've sort of progressively eaten up the whole world. And we've seen the world become more and more interlinked. I mean, globalization, which everybody talks about so much nowadays, this is not a new process. It's just it's happening a lot faster now than it ever has before. And by the 21st century, in certain ways, we can really speak of the world having become one big ball of wax at this point. Now, in earlier periods of history, when you have a dramatic social collapse, even something on the scale of the fall of the Roman Empire, it only directly affects one part of the world. So you can have the Roman Empire collapse. It takes, what does it take, like 1,600 years for social development in Europe to regain the levels it reached under the Roman Empire. But you've got 1,600 years. And you've got other parts of the world, like China, where social development is on an independent trajectory, whereby 1,000 years ago, the Chinese were reaching levels of development. The Romans had been at 1,000 years before that. You've got all these different like experiments in development going on all around the world. In the 21st century, I don't think we really have that anymore. I think we have one big experiment now. And if we mess up that experiment, I think it can have consequences on a global scale that possibly none of us will be able to survive. So that's why I think the potential is there for, like I said, disaster on a scale we really can't begin to imagine.
Sir, I'm Otis Paul. I would like to comment from Jared Diamond's book, Gun, Germs, and Steel. And he cites that, as you pointed, the Chinese led the way with marine technology, with the sailing ships that could transit the Atlantic, but they stopped. And he cites that it was the government's top-down style of decision that occurred even then. So China's taking a big bet because it's still top-down. What's the risk?
Yeah, great question. And yes, I must say, I think Jared Diamond's Guns, Germs, and Steel is one of the best history books written in the last 20 or 30 years, which is quite something, considering that the guy is actually an expert on the intestinal tracts of birds and lizards from New Guinea. So to have written the best history book, the best-selling history book, this is slightly galling for historians. But I mean, his book does many wonderful things. If you haven't read it, I strongly recommend it. It's a great book. But what I think it particularly did was put geography back at center stage for historians and say, if you're going to try to understand the big picture in history, you just cannot ignore geography. It's central to what's going on. So, Jan, I think in some ways, a lot of what I did was very much inspired by what he did in Guns, Germs, and Steel. But like a lot of historians, I felt that what he did there, he had a lot to say about prehistory and a lot to say about the modern world and kind of skipped over the sort of 4,000 years in between. And I think, that's a legitimate thing to do. But I think if you look at the whole story, like I tried to do in my book and tell a continuous narrative, what you see there is that geography works in a rather more complicated way, I think, than Jared suggests in his book. And particularly this whole thing I kept talking about how development feeds back on what the geography means. And that, I would say, that is really what explains the thing that you brought up about the 15th century Chinese ships. Why don't the Chinese go on to come to the Americas? And the Europeans do. And this allows me, in fact, to give you a seizure as I go back through the slides. But go back to the picture, that I mentioned that I'd missed, which is just a map of the world with the Americas set at the center of this. Europe is a whole heck of a lot closer to the Americas than China is. And this is a sort of glaringly banal thing to point out, but it's true. It's about 3,000 miles to get from Portugal to the Americas and 3,000 miles to get back again. It's about 8,000 miles each way from China with the winds and tides you have to use. And getting back to China is really, really difficult to do. That, I think, largely explains what happened in the 15th and 16th centuries. The Europeans are geographically, physically closer to the Americas than the Chinese. Other things being equal, the Europeans, once these ships and guns get invented by the Chinese, they spread rapidly. The Europeans, the odds are stacked in Europe's favor for being the first one to discover the Americas, to breathe European germs on the native population and wipe them out, and to take over the land and integrate it into an Atlantic economy. Now, my guess is that given sufficient time, And this, I must say, also like a methods point. When you're writing a book like this, a lot of it actually consists of asking yourself, what would have happened if things had gone a bit differently? Given sufficient time, I think the Chinese would have discovered the Americas, would have breathed their germs on the natives, would have created some kind of economy tying the Americas into an Asian economy. China would have gone on to dominate the world, given sufficient time. But they were never going to get that time because the Europeans were much closer to the Americas than the Chinese. The Europeans also had a lot more reason to be wandering around the ocean in boats than the Chinese. The Chinese are pretty confident in the 15th century. There is nothing in the ocean to the east, the Pacific Ocean. You sail out there, you're not going to get anywhere sailing out that direction. There's just nothing out there. The Europeans know that China is the center of the world. Most Europeans know that the world is round. Most people know there are all these different ways you could get to China. Christopher Columbus famously thinks he's getting to China by sailing across the Atlantic, which, of course, in theory, you can do that. Almost everybody in Europe in 1490, 1491 is saying, this guy is mad as a hatter. We know you can get to China by sailing into the Atlantic, but it's going to be about a 10,000-mile sail because they know how big the world is. You can't possibly make a profit by sailing to China and back that way. That's stupid. Don't do it. And Columbus eventually wears people down. They give him the money. Off he goes. To his dying day, he's convinced he's been to China. But he hasn't, of course. He's been to the Dominican Republic. Back he goes. The Chinese have much less incentive to strike out into the Pacific Ocean, seeing what's out there. They know they're the center of the world. Europeans who don't agree with Columbus about crossing the Atlantic and who want to sail around the bottom of Africa to get to China, they find that to do that, they have to strike out into the Atlantic anyway, because that's where the winds and tides allow you to pick up these winds and tides will get you around the bottom of Africa. In 1500, the first European explorer bumps into Brazil because he's trying to get around the bottom of Africa. I think it was almost inevitable, once the ships and guns had been created, that the Europeans were going to be the first ones to get to the Americas. And the Chinese decision not to explore out in that direction was actually a very rational thing to do. I think any rational person would have made the decision that they made.
They also built the Great Wall.
Dealing with the steppe nomads was a problem, definitely.
All right. We have time for about two more questions. So,
first of all, First of all, I want to congratulate you able to use the variable to get the quantitative social development index, because that is very important if you want to talk about, you know, a comparison of apple with apple. A quick comment and then a question. I noticed your graph only goes to the 14,000 BC. Interesting or not, how about the out-of-place artifact 15,000 plus and all the ancient history from the Vedas, Sutra, as well as the old plate, you know, Plato's landing and so on. I'm not just a comment on it. My question is really this, 2103. I'm going to beg with you because being a good student, I need to, you know, sort of like question your proposition, you know, professor. And this is this. Let's assume, which you were right in regard to the transportation and the weaponry analogy, that would be our communication for the transportation and the guns as our technology. Because of that, I think the most essential element, and this is my question to you, is the ability of new technology and human resources combine these two would drive. And because of that, I think the world become too small of a scale for humanity to see it as West or East. And the transformation of the new technology prior to, let's say, Iran or Israel going into it, I think we will see ourselves more of a humanity race versus the maybe external forces, either astronomical events or a lot of conspiracists like to say the AA. So I would like you to comment on that.
Yeah, I think I would largely agree with what you were saying in the question part. I think and the way I would guess that things might go in the 21st century is that increasingly the problems that we're facing are ones that operate on a global scale. And I think a lot of people agree on this, whether it's climate change or global terrorism, all kinds of problems operate on a global scale. But the problem we've got is that our most powerful institutions are the nation states that were created basically in the 19th century, which have proved really, really good at dealing with local scale problems and the scale of the nation state itself, much less good at dealing with global scale problems. And I think, say, you know, something like the climate summit in Copenhagen at the end of 2009, I think that's a great example of this. You know, I may be very naive, but I mean, I tend to think that most of the leaders who went there sincerely wanted to produce some kind of binding agreement that was going to be a force for good in the world. But they couldn't. They just, the framework they were operating with of the nation state was one that's designed for a different sort of problem. And so I guess my prophecy would be that either we're going to create institutions that transcend this local scale and do operate effectively at the global level, which, you know, not necessarily a world government or anything, but some kind of institutions that do work at the global scale. Either we do that or we go down the collapse path. I mean, I think the getting to 5,000 points path depends on us having the institutions that will work at this global scale. So, yeah, I think I would agree very much with what you're saying. And I think the technology is one of the big things driving us, making this the choice that we face.
Hi. Thank you for your wonderful talk and sense of humor.
Thank you.
How do you feel about, we seem to be more and more dependent on machines and incorporating, do you think we'll be incorporating machines into our bodies, which I think is a bit abhorrent? And do you personally have any solutions for, do you see any solutions for these five terrible points, you know, the climate change, the diseases, et cetera? What are your solutions that you might have thought of?
Right. Yeah. Well, large questions. and of course, I mean, if I had all the answers, I would have mentioned them by now. But yeah, I guess yes. I mean. One of the things people often like to talk about with the sort of the technological merging of humanity and its creations is the way our ability to process information has been growing exponentially. And of course, I'm sure a lot of people in this room know a lot more about this than I do. I couldn't even get my slides to work tonight. But you know, this exponential growth in computing power that we've been seeing really over the last 30, 40 years or more.
And so, you know, a number of people, particularly here in the Bay Area, have been very interested in saying, well, what would happen if we project that out? Where will that take us? And one of the more influential projections associated particularly with Ray Kurzweil, he suggested that if the scanners that people have continue improving at current rates, by about 20 years from now, we will be able to scan an individual human brain at a neuron-by-neuron level. Because what your brain is basically a kind of carbon-based machine that sends electrical signals around and stores them as your memories. And your personality depends on the particular directions the signals go. We'll be able to scan this on a neuron-by-neuron level. It'll be basically a reproduction of your brain, which could then be mounted onto a computer. And if computers, supercomputers, continue increasing their power at the exponential rate we've been seeing, by about 2030, there will be computers powerful enough to mount and run at full speed an exact replica of your brain. There'll be two of you out there now. And of course, some people say this is ridiculous. That is not how a human mind actually works. It's not quite that mechanical. But Kurzweil and a lot of other people think it is that mechanical. We'll be able to have a duplicate of somebody uploaded onto a mainframe, indistinguishable from the biological carbon-based version, a silicon-based version. By another 10 or 20 years after that, again, if the exponential trends continue, we will have so much computing power that the brains of everybody on Earth can be scanned and merged into a single silicon-based intelligence on a computing platform that will have trillions of times the calculating power of all the people in the world at the moment. Now, if that were to happen, then worrying about East and West or exchange rates or the deficit, that's probably going to be a little bit beside the point. And so, I mean, I guess my response to the second part of your question would be that, you know, obviously we have no way of knowing that's really going to happen. This may be absolute nonsense. Almost all predictions are 99.9% nonsense. But if anything vaguely like that were to happen, then a lot of the sort of forces that we have seen operating throughout human history, I suspect, are going to cease to be very relevant. I mean, worrying about the food supply when, in fact, you are uploaded onto the great database in the sky. Again, you know, it's not going to be a very big deal if that is how things play out. But whether they will, that is another question altogether. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.
So we've run out of time. If you have another question, you can come up afterwards. Of course, projection of exponential curves is always fraught with problems. My favorite is from the mid-90s in the science section of the New York Times, where it was predicted that the fastest woman runner would pass the fastest male runner by the year 2005. Because of the increase of speed in the women runners versus that at that curve. And, of course, Japan was predicted to take over the world in the 1980s and so on. We have these curves at different parts of development, and they change. So unless, of course, all the problems are solved, the only problem left would be, is there enough silicon to create the singularity? But so ends another fascinating discussion at the Commonwealth Club in its 108th year of enlightened discussion. Thank you very much for coming.